Hi, everyone. I'm Anita Lustria, and in my world, conversation is king. A number of years ago, when I lost my big job of being a radio talk show host, I decided I could mope around and be sad. Okay, I did a bunch of that. Or I could move on and start a podcast so I could keep the conversation going. That's how this podcast was born. As you listen, you'll hear about things that are important to me, and hopefully you'll resonate with these topics as well. Welcome to Faith Conversations. So glad you've joined me on Faith Conversations, and I'm excited to welcome back to the podcast, Michelle DeRussia. Is that right, pronunciation?
It is. You got it. You're good.
And I think I did that the first time I had Michelle on. Some of you are going, you said that last time. You'd think it would stick, but you know what?
It's okay. You're one of the lucky few that actually got it right.
So what do they do? To make it a long U?
Yeah, they say DeRussia.
Okay. Yeah.
No. The answer to both.
Well, all right. It's DeRussia, people. So Michelle is back on the podcast. And let me tell you a little bit about her. She is an author, and she's written a number of books, 50 Women Every Christian Should Know, Spiritual Misfit, and Katharina and Martin Luther, which was a finalist in the biography and memoir category very recently, just in 2018, in the Christian Book Awards. And she publishes a monthly column on religion and spirituality for the Lincoln Journal Star, and that is Lincoln, Nebraska, in case you wondered, and writes about learning to listen to your soul on her blog. And I will link to that at michelledeRussia.com. And I just want to say now to you, Michelle, and maybe I wrote this to you, but I sign up for blogs and newsletters and things that I think will interest me. And then inevitably they come into my inbox and I don't read them. And I periodically go through and unsubscribe. And I know a lot of us probably do that. Yours is one of those that I always read. And I'm saying it was some surprise, not that surprise because it's that I thought it wasn't going to be good, but you have captured me by what you have to say, and maybe there's some kindred spirit there, something, but I really like your blogs, and I read them, and I only read one or two other people's. And so anyway, that's a compliment to you.
Oh, it is a compliment because I know how much material and content is out there. So I appreciate that. Thank you so much.
And I also need to just go one step further and say, and you can, I'll link to this in the show notes to the previous podcast with Michelle. I had her on before talking about her latest book, which is True You, Letting Go of Your False Self to Uncover the Person God Created. Who among us cannot identify with that title and that subtitle? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I'm, you know, obviously the resource for this podcast is True You, and I hope you do grab a copy. I have really enjoyed it. And you can see my bookmark is halfway through, so I'm not finished. And I pick it up periodically and read a little bit more because I really do relate.
Excellent. Thank you.
So last time, I enjoyed our conversation so much, I thought it would be wonderful just to have you back to converse about a variety of topics, some of which I grabbed from your blog posts and also from, I think, your latest newsletter. But before we get into that, I have a great story. I'm still beaming because I just hung up the phone before we recorded with Jill. And Jill is a TSA agent at BWI, Baltimore Washington International Airport, on the East Coast. And my husband and I flew out of there in October of this year, and I left in the TSA bin just one little thing. I got everything out of the bin, but must have been stuck in a corner, a very, very favorite bracelet.
Oh.
That is an ID bracelet that says, "Remember to Play," which is something that I need to remember. I wear this bracelet a lot. I am really learning, and moving to Sarasota has gotten me to really lean into play and what it can do, and I can attest to what it has done for my soul. But I left this bracelet in the bin, and I was so sad, and I dug around online and found some company that for $1 million will track it down and send it. And I thought, no, I know I can find, hopefully, the actual lost and found there. And Jill just called me back. She goes, "We have your bracelet," and gave me three different options. And she said, "Give me your email address and I will email you these three options and you decide which one and email us back and we'll send it on the way."
Yay, a happy ending. That doesn't happen very often.
It doesn't.
Especially, I mean, I would think that a lost item at TSA security would just go into the great void of lost items, never to be seen again.
Me too. And I also thought, I've been sitting on this for, well, since October 27th, since the 28th, I've been, I need to call. And somehow I actually called today thinking, you better do this before a month, because I bet they've got a threshold where they, you know, it opens up to the public or to the employees to take whatever. I don't know how long they keep things. I didn't ask.
Yeah, that's an interesting question.
Happy ending. And I said to Jill, I'm just about to record a podcast and I'm going to sing your praises. And I was just about to ask her first name. And she goes, "Jill, tell everyone Jill says hi and that we TSA folks really are nice."
So, I love it. I love it.
Me too.
And Anita, I love that you have a bracelet that says "Remember to Play," because that has been in the last year a big stopping point for me, something that I am trying to remind myself to do. And it sounds so silly, but as an Enneagram 3, and we have talked about how we are both Enneagram 3, so emphasizing striving and achievement and productivity and efficiency and all of those strengths, but sometimes at the detriment of whimsy and fun and curiosity and creativity and all of those good things, which are equally important. So I've been trying to spend a little more time learning, I'm embarrassed to say, at age 49, learning how to play in the last year. So I love that. It really speaks to me that you have a bracelet as that reminder.
Well, you'll find this interesting. When I lost it, I said to myself, you know what, maybe someone else needs it and maybe God feels I've learned this lesson. And I think that's why I didn't call for a while. Then I kind of woke up one day and I thought, no, I don't think I've fully learned this lesson. I'm an Enneagram 3. I won't fully learn this until I'm gone from this world here.
I know. I think that's true, kind of unfortunately for us, but I do think that's true. So we need the reminder. So
we do.
Good. I'm glad you got the bracelet back.
Well, since you brought up Enneagram 3, let me, there are two places I want to go here initially, but one is this. One of the things that matters to Enneagram 3 or can is our appearance or our the facade we put out there, which I like to believe I don't really put a facade out there any longer, but that's been a journey. I'm 10 years your senior, so I'm 59. But we both have made a choice, a decision to let our hair go gray. And I think that's, I want some applause. So, well, there we go. That speaks to the Enneagram 3 right there. But that was a conscious decision, obviously, from both of us. I'd like to hear why you made that decision.
Honestly, I'm super practical. So,
which is also Enneagram 3. So that's
true.
Yes,
that's true. So I went through a very short-lived blonde phase, and it was really pretty. But after maybe 4 or 5 weeks went by, I realized, oh my goodness, I actually need to color my hair again or get my hair colored.
Yes.
And it was expensive and it was a time commitment. And I said, yeah, I'm so not here for this. So that was a decision point. Unfortunately, I had gotten headshot photographs taken for my website during that very short-lived blonde phase. So then the reality of my hair in person did not match how I was represented on my website for a long time. So when I went to speak or went to conferences, nobody would recognize me because I have very gray, white hair, especially if
in
I
the,
pull it back.
In the front. So, that nice stripe in the front that we sometimes get.
I finally got new headshots taken just recently in the last month and updated my website. So, yay.
Oh, well, I have to say, similar reason for me. I decided I was no longer in, which is kind of funny, I was in radio, which, yes, you have photos on website and all that, but, you know, it's not like people saw me every day. But I was speaking and doing things professionally with where I used to work, and somehow it seemed like, you just keep coloring your hair. And then my husband and I moved into semi-retirement, and also it was partly practical. It was expensive, and we were trying to save some money on the front end in semi-retired life. And my decision was I'd rather eat out one extra time a month than color my hair.
Seriously.
So, yeah, I'm like,
priority.
That's right. I'd rather go to some nice seafood restaurant for the price of what I would color my hair.
I would too.
Right? Yeah. So that was why I did it. And it's kind of funny. I'm also letting my hair grow. It's been really short for a very long time. And the longer I grow it, some of the dark is coming in. And that's surprising to me. It depends on the light that you take a picture in, but anyway. So, all right, that's the hair piece. Now let's move on to the next thing.
All right.
How about, I read one of your blog posts and I loved it. I actually wish I had printed that one out, but people can find that on your website. You have authored a number of books. I read all the titles at the front end here. But you came to a decision that you were going to not, and I don't know how you worded it. I'll turn this over to you. You were not going to pursue, writing books anymore. How did you word that? And what brought you to that? Why, what brought you to that? All of that, all those things.
Well, it was a big decision, as you can imagine, and it was a hard decision to make. Until I made it. And then I realized almost immediately that it was the very right decision. So I decided, let's see, True You came out January 1st, 2019. And in the days and weeks following that, I was having many conversations with my husband and my sister and a couple close friends as I came to realize that the traditional publishing arena was not a healthy place for me to have my career, to exist in that arena for a lot of reasons. And I think a lot of those are tied into the Enneagram 3 striving, need to be recognized, this need to be known, admired, all of the sort of shadow side negative parts of being an Enneagram 3 were accentuated or sort of really brought to the surface in a public profession such as being a traditionally published author. And it was on a winter day, I remember this very vividly. I don't know if it was January or February, but it was not all that long after True You came out. My husband and I were sitting on the sofa. It was snowing out. We were having a heart-to-heart. And he said, from where I sit, it seems to me that publishing has brought you more sorrow than joy. And I knew when he said those words that it was the truth. I knew in my heart that that was the truth. And once you know that, once you hear it and you know that you're hearing the truth, like I couldn't turn away from, I mean, I guess I could have. I could have just squelched that back down or denied it, but I just knew that he was right. And, you know, my husband knows me probably better than anybody, sometimes better than I think I know myself. And I knew he was right. And so I knew I had a choice. And I decided pretty much in that moment that I was going to step out of that arena. And it was a hard decision because I was contracted to write another book.
So it wasn't like, you've done this, there's nothing else on the docket, you can end.
I know. Okay. I'd been paid in advance, which I had to write out a check and send back. That back to the publisher.
Wow.
And so there was a lot wrapped up in that, that I had to sort through. Just, you know, I struggled because I have, I think, a strong work ethic. And so I had to sort of navigate through those feelings of, am I quitting? Can I not hack it? Am I a failure? All of those hard questions.
It's big.
Yeah. And I came out the other side. And like I said, I just knew immediately that it was the right decision, even though it was hard. And even though there was, you know, a financial burden there and having to write out that check, that was painful. But in the end, it's been good. And so this whole year since then has really been time that I have spent doing a lot of just inner work. I didn't see that coming. I just thought, okay, I'm going to move on to the next thing. And I didn't realize it really was the beginning of the journey. I thought it was the end of the journey, or at least that part of the journey.
Silly really, you. Silly you. Well, I hear that, though, and I think, you know, it's kind of like being fired from a big job, only you're the one that let yourself go from it, you know? And so there's a whole lot to unwrap with that. I want to go back to where your husband said it just seems that, you know, traditional publishing has just brought you a lot of sorrow. What say more about that? Because there are people listening that don't really know anything about the publishing world necessarily. And what part of it was just a drag and brought sorrow for you?
I put a lot of pressure on myself, to be productive. I mean, I wrote and published 4 books in 5 years, which is a lot and probably too much in retrospect. It's kind of never ending, you know? So the promotional aspect of being a traditionally published author it can be all consuming and it feels never ending. So you're kind of I constantly felt like I needed to grow my audience, build my platform, gain new readers, always keeping an eye on how my books were doing on Amazon. You know, all of those numbers are visible. They're there for anybody to see. So I could see 10 times a day I could go on Amazon and look and see how my books were doing. And at my unhealthiest, I was doing that a lot. And worse than going and seeing how everybody else's books were doing.
Oh, that.
Right?
Yeah.
Because you can see everybody else's Amazon rank too. So I would say, oh, well, so-and-so whose book came out 2 weeks before mine or 2 weeks after mine, her book is ranked this and mine is this. And so therefore I'm failing and she's succeeding. And so there was a lot of comparison wrapped up in that for me. And I think the social media aspect, just kind of feeling like I was just always on. I was just always pushing for the next thing, pushing to produce the next thing, pushing to get more readers and to grow my audience. And it just wore me out. It exhausted me.
You hear that from many authors that true writers, there's a life-giving element to that creative process and to the writing itself, but the promotional side of things and the marketing can be really soul draining.
Yeah. And I mean, a lot of writers are really able to navigate that well. And, you know, we've talked about Sean Smucker, who you've had on your show, and he's a friend of mine. And I just really admire, and not to say that he doesn't struggle sometimes, I know he does, but he is able to just navigate that arena well in a way that is not damaging, it seems, to who he is as a person. So he's not connecting his true identity with his profession. And that's where I struggled so much, and I knew that I shouldn't be doing that. You know, my job is not who I am, but in real time, I really struggled to separate the two.
Do you think, I mean, I'm guessing, but you will need to answer this, that writing True You was a piece of you moving toward this decision?
Oh my goodness. It so was. And I had no idea what that book was going to do to my life. But yes, I think because, you know, True You is all about uncovering the person that God made you to be. And so I did a lot of research and personal soul work to write the book. And so the seeds for this journey that came after that book was published were planted in the writing and the synthesizing of all of that information and soul work that I had done. So yeah, again, what I thought was the end, like, okay, here's the book that I wrote and now it's published and for sale, end of story. Oh no, 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 no. That was the beginning of now. I think God was like, okay, you wrote the book and now we're going to take everything that you wrote and we're going to work you through this process. And I was like, what? I thought I already did this. Oh no, I didn't.
Also known as work you through the ringer.
Exactly. Wow. Fascinating.
Now, the fact that you're not writing books does not mean that you're not writing, because obviously I said at the beginning that you publish a monthly column on religion and spirituality for the Lincoln Journal Star, and I read your blog posts, and maybe, I don't know if you do any other like freelance article writing other places, maybe not.
No, I don't. And in fact, along with quitting book publishing, I also resigned after writing for the paper for 10 years. I resigned from that as well.
Wow.
I really wanted to get to a place in my writing where I was writing for myself and what the spirit moved me to write for my own self. And if it benefits, this is why I still write on my website and not just in my own journal. If it benefits somebody else, well, I love that. That is wonderful.
Yes.
But I'm trying to get to the point where that's not the primary reason that I'm writing. I'm trying not to write for other people's edification, but more for my own. But it's been really hard because after 10 years in the public, you know, publishing, traditional publishing industry, and always thinking about audience and what's called felt need. You've probably heard that term before. Like basically, what does the market want? What is, what's the market drive? What's driving the market right now? What do readers want? It's so hard for me to sort of retrain my brain to get out of that pattern and ask myself, what do you want to write about? And sometimes I feel guilty. I feel like it's self-centered, you know, like self-involved, but I don't think it is. I think that's just the negative voices in my head sort of, I don't know, trying to steer me in another direction. But I've heard from readers who still read my blog. I hear more from readers now than I did a year ago.
That's fascinating.
So I think something must be
connecting
mm-hmm. with some people anyway. And so I'm happy about that.
Well, and I think I have to say, I think your honesty, I mean, aren't we all often, maybe not always, but aren't we often drawn toward people when they start living into their authentic selves?
Yes.
Right.
I think that's true.
I think that's what you're doing.
And I think you can recognize that in other people. Mm-hmm. And it is very appealing.
Yeah.
So sometimes I'll write about something that frankly feels kind of silly and small. Like just this week I wrote about how I discovered that I like to go to the gym after not declaring that I was not a gym person for the last 15 years because of an injury. I ended up back at the gym and I realized, oh my gosh, I don't not like the gym. I actually do like the gym. And then, you know, similarly, went with my son to a greenhouse and realized, oh my gosh, I love plants. I'm going to buy a plant, you know, and it's so silly. Like, well, who cares? She bought a plant, but it's just these little discoveries.
Yes. Yes.
And I got so many emails from people and comments on the blog, like it resonated with people, which made me laugh because I was like, I bought a plant and it's resonating with people.
But isn't that the real deal though? It is not the great big things that people really resonate with. I mean, there'll be a handful, but it's the little incremental things, the little changes, the little discoveries mm-hmm. that we kind of sit up and go, well, we sit up and say several things, I think, in our head, like, oh, you know, the typical, oh, yeah, yeah, me too, that, because it's relatable. It's relatable. And also, it gets us wondering, huh, what might I need to revisit in my life? What's yeah. seemingly small decision? I yesterday spent a little bit of time online looking at silverware patterns because my husband and I relocated 3 years ago to Florida, and we bought a house, as often you do. We are in a manufactured home, and a lot of times they're sold furnished or largely furnished. Well, I inherited a kitchen full of all kinds of stuff, some not so good that I got rid of and some that was good. And I have this mishmash of silverware, and I have been slowly waking up to the fact that I don't like that. I actually would really like something matching. And there are five forks in my drawer that I love and that I hide because I want to use them. I don't want my husband to use them. How goofy mm-hmm. is that?
No, I totally get it. I totally get it.
And mm-hmm. so I woke up yesterday and I said, go search. I looked on the back. It's Oneida, like much flatware is. Go mm-hmm. search their site or Amazon, whatever, and find this pattern and buy the place settings, unless it's some exorbitant amount. Mm-hmm. And I have found them this for 8 place settings for a very good price. It's in my cart. I have not pulled the trigger because it seems, what's the word? It just seems trivial, not over the top, frivolous. Or, yeah. Yes. Uh-huh. But I believe this all goes along with Remember to Play.
Yeah.
This is in the same. It's in that same vein, but somehow Remember to Play feels more, okay, I can do that. I can move toward that because it doesn't cost anything monetarily for the most part. But married to my practical, I'm practical too, so I'm going against type here, but my husband is a 6, cautious and doesn't want to spend any money. You know, mm-hmm. if the place settings cost 25 cents, he'd be down for that, but not, mm-hmm. you know. So, mm-hmm. So I'm kind of going through, thinking this through, and also thinking about why that matters. But some of it has to do with placemaking for me. That can mm-hmm. almost bring me to tears, actually. Mm-hmm. But some of mm-hmm. it is a part of that I'm recognizing in the conversation. I can't... Mm-hmm. I have to process externally, so thank you for sitting across from me because mm-hmm. I'm seeing what some of this is about.
Hmm. Yeah, I love yeah. that. Well, and so I think it's a matter of the fact that we can lose ourselves along the way. And I don't know if this is yeah. more of a gender thing, or maybe it happens to men too, probably does, but just speaking as a woman, we can lose ourselves in parenting, in being a partner, in our jobs. We give so much of ourselves to all of these different areas. And then, you know, my kids are getting older now. I have high schoolers. And so as I'm coming up for air and I've stepped out of my career path and changed directions, I'm realizing I have no idea what I even like anymore.
I was just going to ask.
I have no idea who I am. Like where am I in all of this? It was shocking to realize that. And part of that came out of, a creativity study workbook that I was doing
Julia Cameron.
Yes. The Artist's Way, which I had tried doing a few years ago and I totally poo-pooed it. I thought she was all woo-woo and I don't know. I was like, this lady she's off her rocker. But then I was in Barnes & Noble several months ago and I saw it on a table and I picked it up And it is just the right thing at the right time.
When the student is ready, the teacher will come, right?
Oh my gosh. And it's just been, yeah. It is unearthed. Her questions, and a lot of them are about play and creativity and passion and what makes you come alive. And to realize that I had no idea what the answers were to any of those questions has been really eye-opening and has started me on this whole other journey. Just and that's what, you know, that's what the silverware is, in realizing like you're just making this connection now. It has something to do with placemaking, and a light bulb is going off for you, you know? And yeah. I think it's important. I mean, it sounds frivolous, it sounds trivial, except that it makes us whole people.
Yes.
And that's important.
That's a really good way to put it. It makes us whole people. Because I think we live a lot of our lives as people that are really segmented out with pieces missing that we have consciously or unconsciously decided to stiff arm, you know, and or set off to the side. You know, sometimes we're aware, sometimes we're not. And I'm thinking of you, our 10-year age difference, probably 12 years ago, I met someone who is currently my spiritual director, who's had a huge influence on my life. And she elevated the discussion of play because she knew exactly who I was as an Enneagram 3, especially 12 years ago, very much in the height of my career. And so she also has been the person who has known how to walk with me through leaving/losing that career and yet finding myself, you know, the hard with the good. The hard is so often, almost always, a catalyst, if we choose it, for some wonderful discovery.
I have to read you this quote that I just heard on a podcast this morning when I was jogging. It's by Christine Downing, who I don't know and have never heard of. I heard this quote on a podcast called Hurry Slowly. Jocelyn Gly, who I've just been listening to this off and on for the last year. So here's the quote. The truth that will give us back a lost part of ourselves is also the one that takes away a self to which we have been deeply attached. So does that make sense? So get part of yourself, just what you said, it's the good and the hard together kind of entwined. You can retrieve a part of yourself as you, you know, walk towards wholeness, but it often requires a relinquishing of something, a part of you to which you are deeply attached. And so for me, that was the recognition and the admiration and the being known that came with being a published writer and in that arena and in that sphere. And I was deeply attached to that for a lot of different reasons, you know, related to my ego and all sorts of stuff. And I realized after that conversation with my husband that I needed to relinquish that in order to move closer toward my true self and towards wholeness and just towards a happier, healthier, satisfied, contented person, which I clearly was not. I was so, so unhappy.
So let me ask this. Does your family notice the difference in you?
They definitely do. Yeah. My husband said almost immediately he saw a tremendous change just in my I want to say demeanor, but that's not it's not quite the right word. Just my essence, I guess. You know, I just became more at ease with the world and my place in it, even though nothing had really been clarified. I mean, I had, you know, left my career, and so I was kind of more lost than ever, but yet he could sense and see that there was already transformation taking place.
Isn't that so interesting? Mm-hmm. My husband and I recently took a 11-day trip back to visit friends and family in Chicago, where we lived for 32 years. And I ran into someone that I really had just met, didn't know well at all. And I have written a couple of books, edited a couple and written a couple. And one that's very near and dear to my heart, it was written way back in 2010, so not recent anymore, What Women Tell Me. And it was really memoir, and I wish it had been promoted as memoir, but it wasn't. So, but I walked into this office and this woman was in there and she said, "Hi," and introduced herself. And she goes, "I never reread books, but I reread your book, What Women Tell Me, this week." And there were two responses in me. One, my heart was so warmed by that. Wow, this thing that was really important to me is still having influence and impact in the world, on people. Not so much in the world, but specifically on women, a woman.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And number two, should I be thinking about writing some more? And I've really been grappling with this because I'm really a talker, speaker, obviously podcaster. I was in radio, not a true writer. Yes, I can write. Yeah, certainly. But that's not my first love. So why, and I'm really grateful that I was pushed to write What Women Tell Me and the, et cetera, et cetera. But why was I involved in these other projects? Very much because I was an Enneagram 3.
Mm.
And mm-hmm. My value went up in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so why would I consider doing this again? Because it's really painful and hard work. because I'm not a writer
right,
first.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so every time that thought kind of raises its head, I go, okay, how much of this is ego? What part of this is any nudge at all from the Holy Spirit? And so, you know, that's somewhere in the back of my mind, kind of grappling with that. But I find myself in no hurry. And that I love. That alone says to me, you're making progress. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm in no hurry to make any kind of decision. And I'm not sure there's any decision to be made. So, which probably already speaks. But yeah, it's mm-hmm. interesting, though. But I totally found it attached to ego. Not that compliment. That was not attached to ego for me, but should I continue on? And I met with a writer friend or two in Chicago, and there's always that encouragement from other writers, but I really didn't latch onto it. It's like, that's really nice, but man.
Yeah, I can definitely relate. I think it's a difference between now, when I write a blog post and I hear from a reader, I get a personal email and someone who shares their story with me or why that blog post resonated for them, compared to, say, and this really doesn't happen very often, but it has happened occasionally, just in Lincoln, in my town where I live, especially when I wrote for the newspaper. So people would recognize me in like the grocery store, or I go to a big church, and so people would recognize me there. And that sort of compliment was more ego pumping, you know, it kind of pumped up my ego a little bit. So there's a difference there, I think. It's a little bit subtle, but there is a difference. And so, yeah, knowing how you're reacting. Are you reacting from your ego that's telling you, oh, this feels so good, I love to be admired and known and respected and, you know, having the spotlight shining on me a little bit, versus, you know, just exchanging an email with a reader and it's just, I don't know, it's just a personal one-on-one kind of communication.
Very different. And I think that's why I've settled in also to podcasting. Yes, this is a medium that I know, albeit, you know, it was live radio before, but I value conversation. That's really why I wanted to continue the podcast. I wanted, moving to a new space, I just wanted to assure myself of at least one good conversation a week, you know, and then if there's spillover, that's all good, fine and good. But the other thing that I've been thinking about is you know, if you even have an inkling that you want to write again, well, don't move toward a book. Just do what you're doing, Michelle. Just write some blog posts. And I know how long I'll stay at that. I know it'll be, let's see, maybe 4 weeks I could manage. But a podcast, I'm just hitting the 4-year mark. That tells the story.
Yeah. Well, you have to know, again, getting back to that question of where's your sweet spot? What makes you come alive? So for you, it's a conversation, oral communications versus written communications. And for me, it really is. I mean, I don't like speaking. It used to, goodness gracious, I would have 10,000 heart attacks every time I had a speaking engagement. Or live radio interviews, always just, oh my goodness. I was beside myself with anxiety and fear. So clearly that's not my sweet spot. But if you give me a computer or a journal and I just write through mystery and uncertainty into clarity, that's how I figure stuff out. Like, I can't just do it sitting in my own head, and I can do it to some degree talking with maybe a close friend or my husband, but really I do it through writing. Yeah. That's how I figure stuff out. That's how I figure out what I know in my heart is true. I have to write my way there. Otherwise I have no idea.
And I have to talk my way there. And much to my husband's consternation sometimes. He's always grateful for my dear friends, because it's like, oh man, I can only take in so many words.
Yeah, exactly.
so that's funny. Really interesting. Well, before we end, I always, I think people enjoy this. I enjoy it. And you talked about this in your recent newsletter about what you're reading, what's on your nightstand these days. And I always find that fascinating. So maybe since this newsletter, let me look at the date. Well, no, it was just November 21st. So you probably still have those same books on your nightstand.
Yeah.
So what are you reading these days?
Well, I just finished a novel called Olive Again by Elizabeth Strout. So it's kind of a sequel to her Pulitzer Prize winning novel that was called Olive Kittredge, which is one of my favorite books of all time. Have you read it?
No. And when I heard you say, I think I read that it was one of your favorites of all time. I'm like, no way. That's, to me, that says a lot.
It does. I read a ton, but I always come back to Olive Kittredge.
Wow.
I read it a few times, and Olive Again was just as good. She just totally nailed it. So
are these her first two books? Are these her very first two?
No,
she's a
prolific.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, prolific author. And I've read other books that she's written, and I have enjoyed them, but not nearly as much as this character, Olive Kittredge. She's kind of a curmudgeonly old lady from New England.
I love it.
I think I grew up in Massachusetts, and I think
that's why I like you.
She feels like home to me. I know.
I'm a Mainer. I don't know if you remember, I'm a Mainer.
Oh, that's funny. Well, this book is set in Maine, in a fictitious small town in Maine. And so you're just totally going
to
resonate
with
this.
Okay. Wow. I did not know that.
You have to read Olive Kittredge.
All right.
And then a book that I'm reading right now for my book club, which actually is not in that newsletter, is Maybe You Should Talk to Someone. Have you read this book?
I have not, but I read a review or someone wrote a post, whatever, and it says, I thought I need to read this.
It's so great. It's a memoir about a mental health therapist, a counselor, who herself goes to counseling because she's sort of at a midlife crisis point in her life, and something happens and she needs to work through it. So it's both stories from her own relationships and interactions with her own clients, and then her own journey towards finding a healthier place in her life. And she's so funny. Her name is Lori Gottlieb, I think is her last name. She's just very, very bright, very sharp, and very funny.
Oh,
and
fun.
Super entertaining, but also insightful, because she kind of sprinkles these real, kind of counseling nuggets in throughout the stories that she's sharing. And
who doesn't need a few of those?
Yeah. I mean, it's almost like a little mini therapy session when you're reading this book. So yeah, it's super enjoyable.
Let me ask a question. You said my book club. Is this a book club you're in or one that you have online or something?
Oh no, it's one I'm in, an in-person book club that I've been in with the same ladies for, oh gosh, I think it's like 12 years.
Wow.
I know. It's wonderful.
Yeah. For someone who's recently transitioned, that sounds more than wonderful.
Yeah.
I love that.
It's been a real grace in my life. So grateful for that.
What else? Let's see. I read in, you mentioned the summer book. What's that?
That is a sweet little novel. I can't remember the author's name. Does it say there? She's
no, it like just says you finished. You heard about it from Elizabeth Gilbert
because
she raved
Elizabeth
about it.
Gilbert, right? Who is
Tove Jansson or Janson?
Yeah,
I'm not pronouncing
it. I think she's finished. So I don't know how to pronounce it either. But
Tove.
Yeah, so Elizabeth Gilbert wrote a little Instagram post about this particular book as just a novel that she comes back to over and over again in her life. And it's really just a sweet coming of age tale about a young girl and her relationship with her grandmother.
Oh,
so,
okay.
So there's some sweet life lessons in there. It's a little bit tinged with grief. So there's a little bit of there's a hard thread in there as well, but it's set on an island. I don't know where, I can't remember, but real small island. So it's just very appealing. Just gave me a feeling of like peace and contentment when I was reading it.
Nice. Okay. Well, I have to ask you about one more as an Enneagram 3. Just, I have to mention this title, How to Do Nothing, Resisting the Attention Economy. I have not heard about that. And so tell me about that and what you liked about it.
This was really interesting. So it wasn't exactly what I thought it was going to be. I think I picked it up thinking, okay, this is going to be the magic elixir and it's going to tell me how to chill out and, you know, be relaxed and not so productivity driven, you know, all the things that I'm trying to navigate as an Enneagram 3. It really wasn't about that per se. It was really about sort of resisting, I don't know. It's really,
well, she said,
really,
and I'm reading. So you wrote here, I found Odell's theory, Odell's the author, of attention as a form of resistance, political, social, environmental, to be both intriguing and convicting. So she's talking, I should read this back at the front end of this. you said you picked up thinking it was going to tell me once and for all how to find focus and wholeness. And it turned out to be nothing like that, but in a good way. The book was actually much more complex and sophisticated than the typical anti-productivity, anti-technology theme that you were anticipating. You found Odell's theory of attention, as a form of resistance, to be both intriguing and convicting, gave you a lot to ponder. Oh, and you said, in fact, one of my recent blog posts was written in response to one of Odell's quotes in the book, and you're still thinking about it weeks after. Which blog post was that? Do you remember?
So, yes, I do. It was a blog post that I wrote. Gosh, I wish I could remember the title of it, but it was about my work. My husband and I, a few years ago, were invited to join a racism awareness committee with our denomination synod here in Nebraska. So we basically got an email from the bishop saying, hey, your name was suggested as people who, you know, might find this this compelling. Would you like to join this task force? And so we did, because I grew up Catholic and you don't say no to the bishop. So even though I'm Lutheran now. So we did. And it's been this really slow journey of working. We came together with this group of strangers, right? Mostly white people, a couple Black women, some lay people, some pastors, you know, so all, from all different walks of life, some rural, some urban. And we have worked together over these past years to figure out ways to bring the topic of racism awareness and racism as a sin into church circles and church communities. Wonderful. And so it really was about the power of working maybe in very, very small arenas. So we have a workshop that we created that we will take out to, say, a church, and there may be 10 people that attend.
Yep.
And yet there's something so powerful about dialogue, yes, and conversation in person, as opposed to what a lot of us kind of fall back on these days, which is making sort of big opinionated proclamations and statements. And I have done this ad nauseum on Facebook about various hot button topics, you know, racism, politics, whatever. Mm-hmm. And so that's what Odell, that's one of the examples that this author was talking about. You know, maybe it's time that we step back from these huge platforms, which is basically just shouting into the void,
yes,
you know, or shouting at people who hold your same views, you know, a lot of times,
yes,
if you have a similar, you know, your face, say your Facebook page is made up of friends who,
yes,
a lot of whom hold similar views. So maybe it's time to step out of that arena and into what feels like a drop in the bucket sometimes, you know, like we're going out and talking to 10 people, like what in the world is that going to accomplish? But I don't know. I think it can be very powerful.
Oh, I believe in the power of one. I realized that after having a huge audience in live radio down to a much smaller audience comparatively on a podcast, moving to what I mostly do for a living, which is spiritual direction, which is one-on-one. And I so believe in that. That's really interesting.
That's exactly it. And that is really essentially what her book is about. That's just one example, but she takes it to environmental, social activism, social media, just across the board.
Okay.
And it was really, really interesting. Huh. It was a hard book because she's really smart. And I'm like, oh my gosh, what is she talking about?
Yep. Right.
So I kind of had to work hard at understanding it at parts, but it was good and clearly gave me a lot to think about.
I sent links from your website to my husband, who has just joined here in Sarasota an interracial book club. That is his background and his previous work, and he's very justice oriented and has been searching to find his people here in Sarasota, and was recently made aware of this and is working to start something at our own church, and et cetera, et cetera. And and it's these small steps that we take have an influence that we may never know about, right?
So true.
Yeah.
So true. You just don't know if you have perhaps planted a seed in one person who then may go and have a conversation with another person in some small rural town here in Nebraska. Yeah. I mean,
that's exactly right.
Beautiful work right there. Just one person talking to another person, like job done.
Exactly. And I think the word for you and I, for you, it's keep writing your posts.
Mm.
For me, keep recording the podcasts.
Mm-hmm.
And I always end my podcast by saying to everyone else, keep the conversation going, because that's really how it happens.
Excellent.
Thank you.
That was a perfect ending.
Thank you so much. Great to have you back on the podcast.
Thank you, Anita. It's always fun. I love it. Thank you so much.